Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. June is a big month for the Supreme Court. In the coming weeks, we're expecting 17 decisions affecting issues including the birth control mandate in the Affordable Care Act, harassment in front of women's health clinics, labor union rights, cell phone searches, and the president's power to make recess appointments. A number of decisions have already come down. They affect the ability to lie in political ads, buy a gun while lying to the dealer about who the gun is for, and sue corporations for toxic chemical contamination, just to name a few. So on today's Your Call, we are reviewing some of those cases. What led to the decisions? How significant are they? And what's to come? Today, we're joined by Jesse Choper, the Earl Warren Professor of Public Law at UC Berkeley, and he is an expert on the Supreme Court. Hi, Jesse. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us. And Dahlia Lithwick is a senior editor at Slate, where she covers the Supreme Court. Hi, Dahlia. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. So, Dahlia, I want to start off with you. Which cases are you following closely? Which ones are you most interested in?
Well, I think the case that everybody's on tenterhooks about is probably the one you referred to, the contraception case, Hobby Lobby, just because I think it's become, you know, rightly or wrongly, the case to watch this term. And I think that's because, you know, it pits, on the one hand, you have this family, the Green family, a closely held corporation, very, very religious evangelical Christians, who argue that under the Obamacare birth control mandate, they absolutely cannot provide birth control to their employees because this birth control is an abortifacient. It causes, in their view, an abortion. So you really have this collision of religious freedom of the business owners on one hand, the sort of civil rights of the employees on the other hand, who now have a right and an entitlement to have this contraception. So I've kind of described this case as the sort of crazy stepbaby of the you know, cases about corporate personhood, whether corporations can have feelings, and in this case, whether corporations can have religion, with the sort of abortion doctrine cases that are always, always very controversial, with, you know, the, this whole religious liberties revolution at the court. So it's got a little bit of everything for everyone, and it makes people crazy just to talk about it.
And so we're expecting that one in the next 2 weeks, right?
Yes, I think it'll certainly, probably. The word on the street is it will come down by June 30th.
Okay. And Professor Choper, which cases are you watching closely?
Well, I don't know that I'm watching any one particular one closely. I think the one I'm most interested in, and I am interested in those cases that Dahlia mentioned. The qualification I would put on them is you have to remember that they are not constitutional decisions. Rather, they involve the interpretation of a federal statute, which grants a much stronger protection to the free exercise of religion than does the Constitution itself. I guess the case that I have found most interesting is the case involving the repeal of an affirmative action program. It's called Shuette against BAM. That's an acronym, B-A-M-N, which I forget what it stands for. In any event, it goes a long way towards saying that the current composition of the Supreme Court is very, very stingy when it comes to the question of affirmative action, diversity, racial and ethnic diversity, in schools, and I would think it would apply as well to federal or state employment, and matters of that sort.
What are your thoughts on that? Do you want to elaborate a bit? Because we had on Harvard Professor Lawrence Tribe a couple weeks ago talking about his new book, and he pointed out that what's really interesting about this court is that Justice John Roberts does not believe in affirmative action whatsoever, and then you have someone like Justice Sotomayor who does, and so they're on completely opposite ends of the spectrum. What are your thoughts on that and how that affects decisions?
Well, I think it's accurate. They are. I do think that Chief Justice is very I don't think he believes in affirmative action. I don't think he believes in the use of race one way or another. The whole thing turns at this point on one justice, and that's Justice Anthony Kennedy. He is what is called the swing vote. He's the determinative vote. He has been in all of these affirmative action cases, and he, he's certainly a conservative justice as a general proposition, but there are degrees of, I guess, liberal justices and conservative justices. And I mean conservative interpretations of the Constitution and so forth, not in the strict political sense. Anyway, Justice Kennedy is right in the middle, and he is not a fan of the use of racial means, even to achieve diversity in universities. But he's open to it to a certain degree and does specifically permit certain uses of race for purposes of diversity, particularly in education.
Dahlia, do you have anything to add on this? And will any cases or any decisions that are coming down this month be affected by this issue?
Well, I completely agree with Professor Chober that the guy to watch on this court, and this is not new, this has been the case since Sandra Day O'Connor retired, the guy to watch is Anthony Kennedy, and in case after case, when you notice often these hot-button cases come down 5-4, the determinative thing is whether Justice Kennedy has special solicitude for, the plaintiffs in that case. And so, don't forget, this time last year, the court was handing down the gay marriage cases. And it was Justice Kennedy who really does have a special place in his heart for, the dignity and equal protection rights of same-sex couples. But the same Justice Kennedy was in the five on the big campaign finance case that came down earlier this year, McCutcheon, and that was Justice Kennedy voting with the conservatives. So I think you cannot emphasize enough that where Kennedy goes, the court goes. And I think that the other thing that Professor Chopper said that is so important is that Schutte, that affirmative action case out of Michigan, was almost a Rorschach test for where each of the justices stands on the issue of race. And so you have this strong, strong polemical opinions and concurrences by the justices who simply feel, to paraphrase Chief Justice John Roberts in a different case, the only way to get past race is to get past race. We need to move on. Racism is over. No more of these like remedies because we've worked it out. And then this absolutely breathtakingly heartbreaking, I would say, dissent by Justice Sonia Sotomayor, the only Latina justice, saying this is what it's like to be a minority in America. Mm. And if you can't see this, you can't see America. And I think those anxieties really spill over into that case, and it becomes a conversation less almost about the law and the Constitution and more a conversation about where America is on these race questions. Mm.
That is Dahlia Lithwick. She is senior editor for Slate, where she covers the Supreme Court. Jesse Chopper is the Earl Warren Professor of Public Law at UC Berkeley. And today we are talking about the Supreme Court. A couple weeks ago, we had on Professor Lawrence Tribe from Harvard talking about his new book, looking at the court under Chief Justice John Roberts. And so today we are talking about some of the decisions that have come down so far. And then in 2 weeks, we'll have another show looking at the decisions that are coming down over the next couple of weeks. Really important decisions here. And if you'd like to join us, if you'd like to talk about the cases you've been looking at, the cases you think are most important, if you have any questions about the decisions, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Dahlia, when you look at the decisions that have already come down, you've written about a number of them. Which one really stands out for you?
Well, certainly the affirmative action one we just talked about, certainly McCutcheon, the campaign finance decision that came down early in the spring, I think was a real blockbuster. But for me, the one that was really fascinating, and I can't seem to stop writing about it, is this case called Town of Greece. And this is a case about legislative prayer and the long-standing American practice of opening legislative sessions. In this case, it was a town hall session in a little town called Greece, New York, and they've always been opened with a prayer, and that is, right or wrong, an uncontroversial proposition. The question is when it can be really sectarian prayer, and what happens when, as was the case in the town of Greece, you have decades of prayer that is always Christian, that makes minorities feel deeply uncomfortable. So this was an appeal that was brought by one atheist and one Jew in the town who just didn't feel that they should, in going to their town hall meetings, have to listen to a Christian prayer every time. And the case was interesting because it was really the first time the court has looked at this doctrine for a long, long time, and then came down very strongly saying, you know what, it's okay. We're not going to micromanage what towns do. Even in this case where the prayers were, you know, by all accounts, very, very overwhelmingly Christian, it's not really the obligation of the courts to micromanage how towns parcel out who does the prayer and how the prayer is done. We don't want to be in the business of overseeing that. And again, a very, very passionate dissent in this case by Justice Elena Kagan, saying, you know, are you nuts? Like, the one thing the framers would have hated is the idea of religious minorities protected under the First Amendment being forced, in order to go petition their government, right? They're going to the town council to ask for a stoplight to move or for a zoning ordinance. And in order to do that, they have to put their head down and pray, whether they believe in that prayer or not. So Kagan writes this very, very passionate dissent saying this is not possibly what the First Amendment could allow. But again, it was a fascinating case in which it broke down on this question of sensibilities, sensitivities, which group you're more inclined to be sensitive to, with the five justices in the majority saying, you know, we got to get thicker skin, and if it's going to be, you know, largely Christian prayer, so be it. You can always get up and leave. And the four justices in the minority saying, you know, if the First Amendment means anything, it has to mean that you cannot be coerced into sitting through a sectarian prayer before interacting with your government. Mm-hmm.
Professor Chopra, were you following that case? What did you think of the decision?
Well, I think it's another example of Justice Kennedy calling the tune. Once again, the court split 5-4. And he was with the five conservatives. He, however, on separation of church and state cases, is relatively sympathetic to the claims of government overstepping its bounds in respect to imposing on religious freedom. But the thing that he puts the greatest emphasis on is the audience. That is to say, he's very strong in protecting school children from prayer on the ground that they are much more likely to be subject to pressures, peer group pressures, be with doing what the gang is doing and so forth, whereas adults ought to be sturdier stuff. And that is not the notion that that we have this thing called inherent coercion or peer group pressure, whatever you want to call it, on kids all the way through high school, really, is one that a number of the members of the more conservative wing, it's anathema to them. It says, you know, this is, you know, psychological nonsense and so forth, and shouldn't be part of Supreme Court opinions. Psycho-coercion, I think Justice Scalia once called it. But anyhow, it's a very interesting case, but again, one that is relatively predictable. That's the one thing I think that's happened. I got no surprises this term at all.
None.
So far.
Hmm. Dahlia, have you been surprised by any decision so far?
I'm going to tell you that in 1 second, but I just want to add one fun footnote to what Professor Chopra just said, which is that this week, on Monday, the court batted away another sort of school prayer challenge that had to do with whether students could graduate in a specific very religious venue. And it's worth reading in its entirety. Justice Scalia writes a dissent from the refusal to hear the case, where he likens being forced to listen to prayer that you don't agree with to his own hatred of being forced to listen to, wait for it, Stravinsky and rock and roll. Mm. So, you know, this is Scalia feeling very, very strongly, just as a doctrinal matter. He feels that the Town of Greece case that we've been talking about, this legislative prayer case, actually changes the law, and that the court needed to take this case as a consequence. But I do think it's very, very emblematic of that Scalia amazing pointed way of writing when he says, you know, it's no different to be sitting in graduation and forced to listen to prayer you don't like than being forced to listen to rock and roll and Stravinsky. In terms of being surprised, I think I was a little bit surprised by the Town of Greece case. I thought watching oral argument it might have come out differently, but I think I would agree that largely this court is so polarized along the lines that we've described. I mean, extremely ideologically polarized, and so you almost have a feeling, and I say this as someone who goes in and watches oral argument, that they're going through this theater of hearing the cases and briefing the cases and writing their decisions, but that these justices are who they are and they think what they think. And at the end of the day, you almost think it would be easier to just turn to Justice Kennedy and say, where are we going on this one?
That is Dahlia.
I think that's the way a lot of advocates prepare.
Dahlia Lithwick is senior editor for Slate, and Jesse Chopra is the Earl Warren Professor of Public Law at UC Berkeley. And on today's Your Call, we are talking about the Supreme Court decisions that have been handed down so far. June is a big month for the court. In the coming weeks, we're also expecting 17 more decisions, so we'll have another show in 2 weeks to go over those. So if you'd like to talk about the cases you've been following, if you have any questions about the court and how it operates, you can give us a call, 866-798-8255. We thought it would be important to do two shows because these decisions come down all at once. And if you follow this closely, you can find really great articles by people like Dahlia. But sometimes the decisions come down and people go about their lives and we don't really talk about them in depth. So we thought it was important to do that. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. I also want to talk about the case that really affects the Camp Lejeune Marine Base. We did a show about this probably 2 years ago. There's a really good documentary called Semper Fi that takes a look at so many people who got sick because of water contamination at Camp Lejeune. This place has the highest rate of male breast cancer. And thanks to, well, a whistleblower, really, the Marines actually posted information on their own website. They didn't know they did it, but it showed that the Marines and the government covered this up. So on earlier this month, the Supreme Court ruled that North Carolina families trying to sue could not because there's a statute of limitations. By holding up the state's 10-year limit, the court effectively undercut lawsuits centering on Camp Lejeune, and Justice Anthony Kennedy said, quote, time is the controlling factor. So many Marines were in front of the Supreme Court. Aaron Brockovich was there. They said this is a huge blow to anybody that is affected by toxic chemical contamination. Dahlia, can you talk about the significance of this? This is a really big decision.
It is a big decision, and I think actually you've summarized it perfectly. You know, North Carolina has this 10-year, quote, statute of repose that basically sets the limit on when you can file a claim, and you know, under that statute, the clock starts ticking from the date of the final contamination. Even if residents don't find out, you know, for decades and decades, what has happened. And I think what I would say, if I were to cast this in a slightly larger vision of what's happened at the Roberts Court, is that this is one of those cases that has to do with whether you can even, you know, get into court in the first place. In other words, a lot of these statute of limitations case, remember the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, you know, where she was suing because she was being massively underpaid at Goodyear Tire and didn't find out for years and years after the statute had run. A lot of these seemingly boring technical statute of limitations cases are important because they're different mechanisms of shutting the courthouse door to litigants. And I think one of the big unspoken themes of the Roberts Court era is that using some of these very, very technical doctrines, things that, you know, lawyers like to talk about at cocktail parties, you know, standing, ripeness, mootness, statutes of limitation, pleading standards, things that are very, very technical in an individual case. But if you sort of pan back at what it means for litigants, what we've seen over the years of the Roberts Court is all sorts of cases that have changed the rules for getting into the court in the first place, that have said, you know, not you, not you, not you. And the really big picture is that this is a court that has been, as a consequence of what I'm describing, very, very, very pro-business. Very pro polluter, very, very pro employer, and that it seems that if you put all these little pieces together, these standing, ripeness, statute of limitations, all of these doctrines together, the person who tends to get the short shrift at the Roberts Court is the woman, the disabled, the employee, the ill. And that is a big, big theme that you really can't exactly see until it clicks into view and you say, right, it's harder to get into court.
Well, this was a 7-2 decision. The dissenters were Justices Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Stephen Breyer. And in the, not, it obviously wasn't divided, but Ginsburg wrote, quote, "Instead of encouraging prompt identification and remediation before it can kill, the court's decision gives contaminators an incentive to conceal the hazards they have created until the repose period has run its full course." Professor Choper, what is your reading on this decision? What does it mean for people? For example, I'm thinking about fracking. I mean, what if fracking happens by your home and you don't realize you're sick until 12 or 15 years later?
Yeah, it didn't raise a constitutional issue, but the last time I looked at statutes of limitations was in law school, which is a short while ago. In any event, I was sort of surprised to hear the description or the definition that North Carolina uses, because my instinct is to agree with that. Usually, I thought, and someone should tell me if I'm wrong, that usually a statute of limitation begins to run not simply when you, in fact, knew about it, but when you might have known about it, you know, might reasonably have known about it. So the fact is that I wouldn't think it would run in any event in circumstances like this if it's been hidden along the way, or if it's something that has no symptoms and I take it that that's the situation here.
Let me just add, I think that their legislators in North Carolina have acted very quickly. I saw just this week that they're trying to change the legislation so that they would open the door again for these legal claims for all these, you know, literally thousands of Marines. So I think there is, you know, hope in the way that this gets changed at the legislative level, which is exactly what happened after the Lilly Ledbetter. So this is something that is fixable, but it's going to be fixable by legislators.
And retired Marine Corps Sergeant Jerry Ensminger, whose daughter died when she was 9, she was diagnosed with leukemia, and he's the one that found out that the government covered up the water contamination, said, "This is a sad day. Basically, what the DOJ is trying to do here is take away the very rights we fought for." And again, that documentary, really amazing documentary, is called Semper Fi, Always Faithful. Today on Your Call, we are talking about Supreme Court decisions. We'd love to hear from you. What are you watching, and what questions do you have? We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. We invite you to join today's conversation by calling 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK, or you can post your question or comment at yourcallradio.org. You can send email to feedback at yourcallradio.org. Coming up in 30 minutes at 11 o'clock, the BBC's World Have Your Say among the stories on today's show. We'll hear from fans in Brazil and around the world as the World Cup tournament progresses. And by the end of the show, we expect to know the fate of World Cup current title holders Spain, who may be out if they get defeated by Chile today. That's World Have Your Say coming up at 11 o'clock.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about how colleges are dealing with rape and sexual assault on campus, and how should they? According to an analysis from NPR's investigative team, the number of rapes that get reported at four-year colleges increased 49% between 2008 and 2012, and so many students are now organizing to pressure campuses to take this issue seriously. So that's what we'll talk about tomorrow. And then Friday, it's our media roundtable, and we'll be discussing media coverage of what's happening in Iraq. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the Supreme Court and the decisions that have come down so far and the decisions that are going to come down. We're going to do another show in 2 weeks to talk about the decisions that will come down in the next couple of weeks. Lots of really important decisions. If you have any questions about these decisions, about the Supreme Court, if there's a case you've been following, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. Today we're joined by Jesse Choper, the Earl Warren Professor of Public Law at UC Berkeley. He's an expert on the court. And Dahlia Lithwick is a senior editor for Slate, where she covers the court. And let's hear from Paul in Oakland. Hi, Paul. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question about whether there's some kind of determining factor or why the court refuses to hear cases. I'm thinking specifically of the case of Leonard Peltier. He was convicted in 1976 of murder of FBI agents on the Pine Ridge Reservation. And in 86, the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld his conviction. A couple years later, one of the judges said, you know, the FBI was equally responsible and he should get a presidential pardon, because the case had gone to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court just said, you know, we don't even want to deal with this. So is there any kind of ideological bias or, you know, political determining factor that you could think of that why the court, you know, just doesn't delve into some issues or hear certain cases? Thank you.
All right, thank you. Professor Choper, do you want to take that first?
Well, there is no question but that they are guided by ideology, by their own values. And it's quite natural that it will be. Because when you're interpreting broad clauses of the Constitution, and most of the big cases do involve either due process clause, the Equal Protection Clause, those particular terms are extremely elastic. And there are no generally agreed upon range of matters that cover them and that fall within them. So I think to say that they are governed by ideology is true, but it is inevitable.
And Dahlia, what's interesting is in some cases, looking at the cases the court refuses to take up is almost as interesting as the cases the court agrees to take, right? So we talked recently about the Supreme Court turning down the appeal from New York Times reporter James Risen, who's facing jail for refusing to identify a confidential source.
That's right. They refused to take that. This week they refused to take a pair of huge, huge cases that had to do with bonds in Argentina. But I think maybe the way to think about this, I don't know if this helps Paul or not, but it's really important to think about the fact that the court only actually takes about 1% of the cases that are appealed to it. So sort of trying to sort through some principled reason for why they take 1% means sifting through that 99% to sort of figure out what went wrong. It seems to me that really the better question is, why did they take the 1% that they take? Hmm. And the court is certainly guided by certain rules. In other words, if there is what's known as a circuit split, so that one court of appeals from, you know, say the Fifth Circuit disagrees with a court of appeals from the Second Circuit, well, that's much more likely to make it onto the court's radar. You know, as Professor Chopra says, if there's a constitutional question, the court's much more likely to take it. But really, given that the court bats away 99% of the things that comes its way, it's almost hard to say, you know, why didn't they take, you know, Reason's case, or why didn't they take the Argentina cases, because they don't take anything. And the last thing I think I would say about this is that, you know, it takes four justices to agree to hear a case, but it takes five to win. And so think of that as a sort of a, you know, if you're a tactical person, if you're a game theorist, you can't, have to not only want to take the case, but you have to know that it's going to come out the way you want. And so I think for the justices particularly, you know, if the one thing we've said over and over on this program is that this is a 4-4 court with a swing justice in the middle, I think unless any individual justice is 100% certain that Justice Kennedy is going to align with them, it in some sense makes perfect sense not to take cases, because it's a tactical risk. And so, for instance, a lot of people ask, why hasn't the court heard an abortion case in years? There's gajillions of those bubbling up. Why hasn't the court taken another big death penalty case to talk about lethal injection? I think that some of that wiggle room between the four justices who want to hear the case but not knowing there's going to be a fifth justice to take the position that they want to take explains why some of these cases just never come back.
Hmm. Well, we've got a question on the James Risen case. And again, New York Times reporter James Risen said that he would rather go to jail than reveal his sources. So let's hear from Roseanne in El Cerrito. Hi, Roseanne.
Hi there.
Rufan. Hi, Rufan.
That's okay. I wanted to ask when you had Lawrence Tribe on and didn't get in, but I think you've partially answered my question, that when you were saying that it's more indicative of the number of cases they take than the rationale for why they don't take certain cases, because I thought it was a statement when they didn't take the case that it was saying something. And I just wanted to hear thoughts on, because I was really disturbed by, you know, that James Risen didn't get his day in court.
Well, I'm sorry.
Professor Chopra, go ahead.
The fact is that this has been the law for 40 years. And although there are some in a minority who want to give a First Amendment right to a what was again called a Doosman's privilege, they just can't get the votes. So when you have a case like this, unless you are pretty confident, as Daniel Ellsberg said, that unless you're pretty confident that you're going to accomplish anything, you're just wasting a lot of time.
Mm.
There's a very famous case also involved, a New York Times reporter was one of two cases before the court. I would say this was in the 70s, and he was made party to plans and so forth of the Black Panther movement at that time. And he swore when he went in to them, you know, he promised that he wasn't going to disclose anything that they had to say. And you don't have to disclose it, but you can sit in jail for a long time if you don't, and some reporters have.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in with that question, Ruthann. We've got a couple of emails. Art in San Francisco, what other conservative trends do you see in the decisions that could impact progressive ideals and values, such as voting rights, racial equality, environmental equality, etc.? What are the cases in regard to this that you think the public should watch out for? Dahlia?
Wow, that's a great question. I mean, I think that, you know, one of the trends that I've described, and I think this has been pretty well documented. I don't want it to look like it's just my opinion, but if, you know, this pro-corporate court theme has been borne out, I think, pretty steadily by the empirical data that just shows how often, for instance, the Chamber of Commerce when they, you know, are parties to a case, how often they prevail. So I think we are seeing, you know, a massive pro-corporate court. I think the other trend that almost is too obvious to bear saying is this idea of corporate speech and corporate personhood. So this, you know, isn't just Citizens United. This is this year in McCutcheon, right, the other follow-on case to Citizens United, and we saw by a 5-4 margin the court saying, you know, oh, you know, this kind of corporate political speech is, you know, this is really, really protected speech, even if it means, you know, in the case of McCutcheon, you know, drowning out, you know, a handful of millionaires, drowning out the speech of, you know, tens and tens and tens and thousands of people who then feel disaffected from the political process. And the court pretty blithely says, you know, it's not corruption for a handful of millionaires to more or less control the political process with big donations because it's not quid pro quo corruption. So I think, again, this idea that, you know, the very, very wealthy, you know, are different than you and me is a theme to watch. I think another big theme to watch, you know, and I don't think this tracks conservative liberal lines, but I think it's really worth watching, is the court struggling with these new technology problems. Mm-hmm. And we haven't talked about that very much. But I would think one of the reasons that the court bats away the Reason case is has to do with, you know, the last time the court heard a reporter's privilege case was in, 1973. And the whole world has changed. The media world has changed. And even as Congress struggles with media shield laws, what are we going to do? They have to answer these questions of who is a reporter and is a blogger a reporter and who are your sources and what is a newspaper. And these questions of, in this era, how we map on, you know, 200-year-old doctrine onto new technologies is an issue for the court in so many areas, and it is fascinating to watch the court struggle with those problems.
Right, and also the privacy issues that are connected to all of this. Professor Chopra, what would you add to that? What do you think we should watch out for when it comes to things like, you know, voting rights, racial equality, environmental equality?
Well, I think you've got to... I must say, I hate to sound like an echo, but or a recording, but you must look at Justice Kennedy. See, I mean, he, for example, in the Justice Kennedy has been, and there are some statistical studies I think that show this, has been the strong, even though he's a conservative, or he's certainly conservative leaning, is the most pro First Amendment free speech justice on the court, and he is that he more consistently than anybody else, regardless of what the underlying speech involves, tends to favor free speech. I don't mean he always finds it, but I say he finds it more often as a single justice than anybody else, and he has from the very beginning felt that. And once again, one has to emphasize that he is, you know, the least conservative of the five conservative-leaning justices. He's more conservative than Justice O'Connor. And when she went off the court I guess it was 2000, it made a great big difference because she was replaced by a much more consistently conservative Justice Samuel Alito. At that time, you could argue either to Kennedy or to O'Connor. Now he's the only game in town. And he'll side in one case with the liberals when they favor free speech, and he'll side with the other case with the conservatives when they favor free speech. And he does that consistently. So I think the thing to look for is, at least on constitutional issues, where he comes out on these sorts of things. It is absolutely amazing to look at the number. I don't have my statistics handy, but on the enormous percentage of cases, especially 5-4, in which Justice Kennedy is in the majority.
That is Jesse Chopra, the Earl Warren Professor of Public Law at UC Berkeley. He's an expert on the Supreme Court. Dahlia Lithwick is a senior editor for Slate, where she covers the Supreme Court. And on today's Your Call, we are talking about the decisions that have come down so far. We'll have another show in 2 weeks to talk about the decisions that are to come. And we'd love to hear from you if you've got any questions about the court, how it operates, if you want to talk about a case you've been following. I hope we have time. There's so many other decisions I want to get to. Maybe we can just go over them briefly, because there's some really, really important ones affecting guns, affecting political ads, affecting BP paying claims. We'll talk about those in the next 10 or so minutes. And you can give us a call, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Art, thanks for the question. I'll get to your other two in just a couple minutes, but I want to go through a few calls first. Let's hear from Roger in Fremont. Hi, Roger. Hi, Roger. We can't hear you very well. Are you there? Oh, much better. Go ahead.
Yes. Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. Yeah, my question, and thank you very much for taking the call, is for the first time on this court, we have no Protestants. We have no non-believers, no anybody. You know, we have what? We have six Catholics and three Jewish people. Do you feel that this will drive court decisions? You feel this is an impact? The reason I ask is I'm concerned about, like, abortion issues and some other issues that, you know, well, let's put it this way. I think some of the judges in the past 15, 20 years have been recruited out of conservative think tanks, and I think there may be a predisposition. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Professor Chopper, do you want to take that?
Well, once again, when he's, the fact is that values play a large role in interpreting these very broad phrases of the Constitution. What your religious beliefs, or it's just one set of beliefs that you can have, and it's not an unimportant set of beliefs. Sometimes people overcome these beliefs, and sometimes they don't. One of the most consistent liberal justices on the court for more than 30 years was Justice William J. Brennan, Jr., who was a devout Catholic. Nonetheless, he voted for in favor of a woman's right in respect to abortion. He voted in against aid to church-related schools consistently. So you cannot take a particular individual and say that is the way he or she is going to vote. They also change.
Right.
There's no question that there's been an evolution of certain justices, quite marked, in fact. And we could go over some names like that as well. So I don't know. I don't mean to overcomplicate it, but it does seem to me that it, when you're working with the human mind and what motivates the exercise of certain values, this is a matter for psychiatrists or psychologists, not for lawyers.
Well, thank you for calling in, Roger. I wanted to get to a couple of these other cases because we're almost running out of time. Dahlia, you wrote a really good piece, What's Scarier Than Truthiness in Politics? A Law Banning It. Can you tell us about the Susan B. Anthony list versus, is it Dreyhaus?
Yeah. This is a case that comes out of Ohio. It was just decided on Monday. And in effect, this is a challenge to a statute in Ohio that's a truth in politics statute that just says you can't go around lying about people in the elections context. And it, in fact, criminalizes false speech. And it's particularly creepy because there's a sort of board of truth that makes those determinations. And Susan B. Anthony List is a pro-life group, and they wanted to put up billboards in the 2010 election, saying of Stephen Dreyhaus, who is a pro-life Democrat, you know, shame on Steve Dreyhaus. He is for taxpayer-funded abortion because he supported the Obamacare law. And Dreyhaus said, you know, it's as a factual matter, there is no taxpayer-funded abortion in that law. Therefore, they're lying, and therefore he brought a complaint before this Ohio board. And the question for the court was not whether that law is unconstitutional. The court deftly dodged that question on Monday. The question was whether this group, the Susan B. Anthony list, and remember we talked about boring things like standing and ripeness and mootness, whether because they were not harmed because the billboards didn't go up and Dry House lost anyway, so nothing really happened. So the question was whether they had standing to even bring the appeal since nothing bad happened to them. And the court, by 9-0, and this goes to, I think, Professor Chopra's, you know, argument that this is a very speech-protective court, they said you have standing. You go back and you litigate this case whether or not anything bad happened to you, Susan B. Anthony list. You can still get into court even nonetheless because this is an important case. So this kind of goes to, and this is not the first time the court has been protective of false speech, blatantly false speech, but I think that it really goes to this idea that the court feels very, very strongly that even if you're lying, even in an election context, that's a pretty ambiguous proposition. But again, this case did not get to the merits of whether that statute comes down. It did say to Susan B. Anthony list, you all go ahead and litigate this.
I would say particularly in election contests. This is a criminal penalty.
Mm-hmm.
If you impose a criminal penalty on every one running for political office who doesn't tell the absolute truth, we would have to triple the number of prisons, even in California.
I also wanted to ask you both about the ruling against straw purchases of guns. It was a 5-4 mm-hmm. vote. The court allowed a prosecution under a federal law that requires gun buyers to disclose they're making their purchase for someone else, even if both the straw buyer and the real one are eligible to own guns. I'm just actually taking some quotes from Adam Liptak of the New York Times. The case involved Bruce Abramski, a former police officer in Virginia, who bought a handgun for his uncle who lived in Pennsylvania. At the gun store, Bruce Abramski filled out a federal form indicating he was buying the gun for himself. He pleaded guilty to making a false statement, but reserved the right to appeal. He was sentenced to 5 years on probation. And Professor Chopra, have you been following this case?
Well, I did. I did look at it, and it was an interesting split on the court because there were, I think it was 7-2, as I recall. But they said it's perfectly clear that he did falsely represent who the gun buyer was. It certainly was a deliberately false statement of material fact who the buyer was. That's what the statute said. They interpreted the statute to say that that's all right. I mean, that's what Congress meant to cover when they passed this federal statute. Justice Scalia joined, I forget how many. Do you remember how many dissenters there were?
It's a 5-4 opinion.
It was 5-4.
It's 5-4, so. Usual suspects, yeah.
Yeah, the usual suspects. So he wrote, and I just looked at it very quickly, but he said, well, it really wasn't material because there's no question about the fact that he was going to give the gun to the uncle. He was buying it for the uncle, and that the uncle could have bought it himself, and there were no problems. The uncle was not going to be denied the right to buy the gun. So you can say it broke down on the gun control issue, the extent to which they are conscious about knowing that this is a gun case and not. It is hard to say. But they changed their minds. You know, there was a very famous case involved burning the flag and whether that was protected by the First Amendment. And Justice Scalia voted in favor of the First Amendment, saying, yeah, you could burn the flag. He tells the story of his going down to breakfast the next morning. It was, plastered on the front page in the newspapers that he had joined this opinion. And his wife was there preparing breakfast and humming "It's a Grand Old Flag." So she was sort of sending him a message. So sometimes they vote very clearly against their values, sometimes they don't.
Mm-hmm. So, Dahlia, at the end of the day, what does this decision mean?
Well, it's a surprising loss for the NRA. I think first and foremost, you know, the NRA has been unbeatable at the ballot box, unbeatable in the State House, and unbeatable at the Supreme Court since the Heller decision, you know, saying that there is an individual Second Amendment right to bear a handgun. Since then, you know, the NRA has been awfully happy with the court, and this was a rare loss for them. And I think that's a big takeaway. I think a big takeaway is they're maybe not, I'm going to use the word bulletproof and regret it, but not completely bulletproof even at the high court. You know, one of the other interesting things that happens in this case that's a little bit fun if you're a Supreme Court reporter is that both Scalia and Kagan do the dueling dictionaries in their opinion. So Scalia's sort of trying to parse what it means to purchase a gun, and, you know, he pulls out his dictionary and says, you know, clearly it's not contemplated what the majority says, and Kagan similarly pulls out her dictionary, and they have a fight about that. But that's always great fun, and to me, this is one of those cases that highlights just fabulous writing on both parts. Mm. I think we have a couple of really fantastically fun writers at the court. Mm. Scalia probably chief among them, but Kagan really holding her own. Mm.
Well, and also we're putting two shows together about guns in the coming weeks, the history of the Second Amendment and what happens if you treat shootings as a public health issue. So if any of you have guest ideas for this or angles we should take that aren't getting enough attention, we would love to hear from you. We've got just about a minute left. Professor Chopper, any other decision you want to briefly tell us about? Because these things are so easy to miss.
I think one wants to look for the recess appointments.
Oh, right.
Case that's going to be decided within the next 10 days. And I think, you know, that'll be a very interesting case as to whether President Obama, like I should say a number of his predecessors, irrespective of party, whether he's abused that by defining the term, you know, the Constitution says you could have these appointments during a recess. And what the Congress does is that they preserve no recesses. Mm-hmm. They meet for 15 seconds every now and then quickly and meet and dismiss and go, you know, the rest of them go back to their vacation. So it's going to be a pretty interesting case.
Yeah. And we're going to do another show in 2 weeks to talk about that decision. Dahlia, we're almost out of time. Any other ones you want to briefly mention?
I would just tell people to watch for the abortion clinic buffer zones, that bubble of silence around abortion clinics, because I think it's going to tell us a lot about, again, where the court is on free speech and the right to be let alone. And I think the Aereo case that has to do with more or less stealing television and the technology around stealing broadcast television is a fabulous case to watch.
All right. Well, we will talk about those decisions in about 2 weeks. Dahlia Lithwick is senior editor for Slate, where she covers the Supreme Court, and Jesse Chopper is the Earl Warren Professor of Public Law at UC Berkeley. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. How should colleges deal with rape and sexual assault on campus? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about this growing epidemic. According to an NPR analysis, the number of rapes that get reported at four-year colleges increased 49% between 2008 and 2012. Students have organized to pressure campuses to take this seriously. So how are campuses currently dealing with sexual assault, and how should they? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.